This is Audible.
The Son of Ishtar by Gordon Doherty. Narrated by Jonathan Keeble. Prologue. Hattusa, capital of the Hittite Empire, 1315 BC.
Last night I dreamt of skeleton hawks, said the bald, waxy-skinned priest. They banked and swooped above the storm temple, clutching hale nestlings in their talons. Shrieking, maddened, they cast the young down, dashing them on the cold, hard ground. It was a dream of death.
King Masili sank to one knee, deaf to the bleating words, every sense instead fixed on the ailing newborn in his arms. His long, night-black hair hung like a veil as he dipped his face towards his feeble son, his tears spotting on the babe's blue-tinged lips.
Hattusili,
Masili said, his throat thick and raw. It was a name of strength, a name of famous predecessors.
Hattu.
But the babe's every breath grew shallower. The king looked up, towards the birthing stool before him. Slumped upon it was his beloved queen, Gasula, naked, skin greying and stained with her own blood, as frail as baby Hattu. Masili had witnessed such traumatic births before, and the burning pyres that followed.
No. Not my queen. Not my boy,
he begged the ether.
My dreams foretold this, my son,
the priest persisted, his eyes reflecting the light of the tallow candles and sweet frankincense flickering on the stone floor around the stool. The storm outside raged as if to underline the claim. Lightning scored the night sky. Thunder shook the heavens. A gale keened, and rain lashed the purity hide, sealing the stony birthing chamber's outer door.
And Hittites should always heed their dreams.
The words tore Masili back to reality. His head snapped round to pin the priest into silence, the winged sun disk on his silver circlet accentuating his angered brow. Then he looked up and around the ring of others. The midwives gawped at him uselessly, their arms wet with blood to the elbows. The augurs, too, could only look on fearfully.
Do something, he growled.
His gaze snapped onto the wise woman.
Repeat the prayer to the goddess of birth.
But the withered yellow-toothed hag was impassive.
The rites have been recounted, Labana. Repeating them will achieve nothing.
Then slaughter another crow. Another lamb,
he demanded.
Those slain already were enough,
the wise woman drawled.
The gods will not be pleased at senseless butchery.
Masili shot to standing.
The gods, they have abandoned me.
He stared at the high ceiling of the chamber, thinking of the skies above and the thousand divinities of his sacred land.
Is there none who will spare me this tragedy? None?
Be careful, my son,
the wise woman advised.
Such appeals can echo far into the void.
I will give you anything,
Masili cried, ignoring her.
My son,
the priest beseeched him. Masili shouldered him away.
Spare their lives. Spare them from the dark earth, and I will honor you.
He lifted the ailing baby Hattu aloft like an offering.
My child will honor you. Hear me!
He roared. Silence. Nothing but the pounding of rain. He slumped with a deep sigh. A midwife took baby Hattu from him, and the well-meaning priest rested a hand on his shoulder.
You must entrust them to the healers now.
Masili made a protest, but as he swung to the priest, a fog of exhaustion passed over him. Spots swam across his eyes. He swayed and almost fell, only for the priest and others nearby to catch him.
My son, you must rest,
the priest wailed.
It has been 3 nights since last you slept.
A fresh protest welled in Masili's throat, but died on his tongue as another wave of fatigue washed over him. Steadying himself, he saw the Asu healers lifting Gasula to a bed near the birthing stool, while a cluster of others placed Hattu on a towel-clad bench, edged with jars of curative waxes and potions.
The gods are silent, he thought. And so men must decide the fate of my beloved ones.
My son, please take leave of this room and rest,
for a time at least. Perhaps,
he snapped. Staring through the fog of exhaustion, he let the priest guide him from the birthing chamber and through the palace.
But you will summon me as soon as anything happens,
Masili said as they came to his bedchamber. It was an order, not a request. The priest assured him, and in moments he was alone. Numbly, he lifted off his circlet, prized off his boots and cloak, and lay down, beset with worry and uncomforted by the soft linen bedding. There was not a chance that he would sleep, he was sure. But when the tallow candle by his bed guttered and died, exhaustion crept up on him like an assailant, tossing a black veil of oblivion over his weary mind. It was a deep, dreamless, restful slumber. For a time. And then the dark oblivion parted like drapes. He realized he was standing on cold, rough ground, a finger of dire grey light shining down upon him as if from an unseen moon. All else remained in shadow. Was this a dream? Was he alone in this strange netherworld? The answer came in the form of a growl, a deep, throaty, inhuman growl that dripped with menace. When a lion prowled across one edge of the gloomy finger of light, its leathery black lips peeling back to reveal yellow fangs dripping with saliva, Masili clasped in vain for the hunting spear he did not possess. He started to back away when a second growl from behind him turned his legs to stone. The two lions began circling him watchfully. And then a third figure emerged from the ether before him, an impossibly tall woman, sun-kissed and naked, bar a silver necklace of an eight-pointed star and a diaphanous scarf around her broad waist. Her dark locks tumbled around her heart-shaped face, then on to cover her bare and weighty breasts. But she was no woman, for her legs below the knee tapered into the gnarled talons of an eagle, and sprouting from her back were shuddering cascades of feathers, wings. At once he understood. The goddess of many names. Inanna. Shauska. Ishtar, he whispered, wide-eyed, dropping to his knees. He thought of everything this goddess represented, love, fertility, war, and of her reputation as the bearer of bittersweet fruits.
My pledge was sincere,
he stammered, understanding this dream now. His pleas had been heard.
Save my queen and my child, and I will do anything for you, as will they.
With a glint in her cat-like eyes, Ishtar walked around him, hips swaying. Her talons clacked on the dark ground as she went.
Only one can live, she replied with a throaty purr.
Masili balked. Had he misheard her?
I don't understand.
I can heal Gasula or Hattu. Not both. One must journey to the Dark Earth. So who is to die, King Masili? Your queen or your boy?
What had she said? The word stabbed like a knife into Masili's heart. The bittersweet fruit had been offered.
I will not choose, he said.
Then both will die,
she hissed, receding into the blackness.
No, no,
Masili begged, one hand outstretched.
How can a man choose between his wife and his child? Guide me. Help me at least.
She halted at the edge of the grey light.
I see two futures, she said. In one, your wife regains her strength and grows old with you. Yet her life will be an unhappy one, spent by the meadow of the fallen, weeping over baby Hattu's bones. When she is on her deathbed, she will tell you she wished she had died along with the babe. It will crush you.
Cold pins pricked Masili's heart at the mere thought of his sweet Gasula in such torment.
And the other?
He asked cautiously.
In the other, Gasula's pain will be short. She will perish, but Hattu will never have known his mother, and so he will not grieve for her.
Masili hesitated, then whispered.
And if Hattu lives, will he lead a good life?
Ishtar remained silent for a moment, and Masili thought he noticed something of a smirk on her lips. At last she parted her arms, closed her eyes, and began to sing in a voice of molten gold.
A burning east, a desert of graves, a grim harvest, a heartland of wraiths. The son of Ishtar will seize the grey throne. A heart so pure will turn to stone. The west will dim with black boats' hulls, Trojan heroes, mere carrion for gulls. And the time will come, as all times must, when the world will shake and fall to dust.
She opened her eyes again.
This I foresee if Hattu lives.
Masili's eyes darted as he combed over the words of the song. It made little sense, apart from one line.
The son of Ishtar will seize the grey throne, he croaked. You speak of Hattu?
Yes, she purred. It has been some time since Hittite kings and princes took up swords against one another. But if Hattu lives, he will be your fourth son. Four sons, and just one throne to inherit.
Hattu would turn upon his own kin. He searched Ishtar's face in desperation. Ishtar beheld him with a doleful look.
It will begin on the day he stands by the banks of the Ambar, soaked in the blood of his brother.
Masili recoiled at the thought.
No, never.
He raised a shaking hand, one finger wagging briefly, daring to show his anger to the goddess.
This is a trick!
She stretched to her full height, wings extending, lips receding to show sharp fangs, and her eyes suddenly ablaze like coals.
Enough!
The goddess bawled, like a vengeful dragon, so as to make the ether of the shadow world tremble around him.
Make your choice, great king of the Hittites. Who is to die?
There was only one answer, but the words stuck in his throat. Yet he knew, in the pit of his heart, that if Gosula was here in this foul dream, she would give that same answer. Heartsick, he whispered at last,
Save my boy.
He woke and sat bolt upright in his bed, lashed with sweat. A flicker of lightning illuminated his chamber for an instant, and he saw the ancient and vividly painted carvings of the gods on the opposite wall, Ishtar amongst them. Nearby thunder pealed as the essence of the dream crept across his flesh like a winter chill.
A dreamer no more,
he muttered, before he remembered the words of the priest and that most ancient mantra, Hittites should always heed their dreams. Suddenly the muffled voices of the birthing staff, raised and urgent, echoed through the palace. At once his head snapped round to the sound. In a panic, he rose and stumbled barefoot through the unlit passageways, jagged flashes of lightning his only beacon, until he barged back into the birthing chamber, eyes wide, maddened. All stared at him, all speechless. Gosula lay on the bed, her eyes gazing into eternity, lips blue, chest completely still. A crying midwife cradled baby Hattu, the babe equally lifeless.
Queen Gosula passed into the dark earth a short while ago, my son,
she wept.
And the boy stopped breathing just a moment ago.
No,
Masili whispered, stepping forward to take Hattu. He held the tiny fawn to his chest and stared at the ceiling of the birthing chamber.
This is not how it was supposed to be,
he cried.
You made me choose. You made me choose.
Thunder cracked directly overhead, drowning him out and shaking the chamber. In the same instant, the gale outside gained immense strength. The purity hide stretched over the chamber's outer door, bulged inwards, and then one edge snapped free, the pegs holding it there spinning across the room. The tallow candles roared and spat at the sudden intrusion of storm wind and driving rain. The birthing staff shrieked in fright, their robes and hair rapping as they backed away. But King Masili did not move, despite the scourging rain, but the tiny bundle in his arms suddenly convulsed, then took a full gasp for breath. Baby Hattu cried out at last,
in time with the storm.
12 years later. Chapter 1. Shadow Prince. Spring 1303 BC. The alder woods north of Hattusa were still and tranquil. The noonday sun blazed in the cloudless pastel blue sky, and all was quiet but for the croaking cicadas and the occasional drumming of woodpeckers. When a branch near the southern tree line shuddered, a flock of song thrushes scattered. The muscled arm reached up to still the branch. Bagrat, the amber-haired Kaskan scout, fell to one knee, eyeing the pale-walled hillside city beyond the forest. As a youth, fireside yarns about this place had stoked his dreams. Hattusa, the rocky heart of the enemy realm, where the Hittite king lived in a high palace, well-appointed with precious relics and smoking pools of molten silver. Since his boyhood, he had helped topple the walls of many Hittite cities. But this was a city like no other. Such stout walls, such high towers. Too high, surely. The trees behind him rustled again. He swung round to see a stout and tall warrior with a tangled mane and beard, both rusty and dashed with grey. He was crowned with a bronze cap, a glaring lion's skull fused to the metal, the two fangs stabbing down to serve as cheek guards. A fine black leather breastplate, engraved with a swirl of silver, hugged his torso, and he wore a vicious double-headed axe across his back.
Lord Pitaga,
Bagrat quailed.
You should stay back from the open country. If the Hittite patrols see you,
Pitaga ignored him, turning his hunter's eyes on Hattusa. He lifted one foot up on a rock and rested his arms across his knees, a ravening half-grin pulling at his lips.
I do not fear the Hittite soldiers, scout, and I will show that.
He lifted and wagged his finger once at Hattusa.
And this will be my reward.
He patted Bagrat's shoulder.
Yours too. Aye. Before winter comes, those walls will tumble. The streets within will run red. And not a soul will be spared.
Bagrat felt a shiver of excitement at the grand claim, his earlier misgivings suppressed. Such was Pitaga's gift. The Lord of the Mountains could inspire the 12 tribes of the north like no other. He looked at Hattusa again. Perhaps it was possible. From behind, somewhere in the woods, a distant scrape of rock sounded. Alarmed, Bagrat's head snapped round, peering through the trees. Nothing. Then he noticed how Lord Pitaga's gaze looked not into the woods, but above. A sheer-sided ridge of silvery granite protruded from the heart of the forest like a shark's fin. The shaded southern side was etched with a grand scene of the Hittite divinities. Tahunda, the storm god, wore a high, thorn-studded hat and stood upon the shoulders of the twin bulls, Ceres and Huris. The carving was ancient, cracked, dotted with falcons' nests and threaded with vines. Bagrat was confused for a moment. Then he saw what had drawn his master's eye. Scaling the rock face high up, there was a lean, dusky-skinned boy, a Hittite boy, wearing just a pale linen kilt. He was merely a dot by the storm god's neck. And even from here, it was clear he was in trouble. Pitaga's half-grin widened.
Into the woods, scout. I haven't shot my bow in months.
Hattu's limbs trembled with fatigue. His odd eyes, the right one hazel and the left one smoke-grey, were fixed on the storm god's lower eyelid. It was high above, too high. But there was nothing else. His inky hair traced along the nape of his neck as he switched his head to and fro. No other way up. Despite all his training, he glanced down. The forest floor seemed impossibly distant. The fallen trunk he had vaulted over, down there now, small as a twig. When a gentle breeze tugged at him, his belly flooded with ice water. His numb fingertips and toes tightened on the meagre crimps he clung to. At once, he wanted nothing more than to be on flat, safe ground. To be Hattu the scribe, Hattu the forgotten son of the king. Just as terror looked set to overcome him, a welcome voice echoed from the broom of memory, the voice of his brother, Sarpa.
Master your doubts,
and you will master the climb. Hattu closed his eyes and marshalled his ragged breaths as best he could, slowing them and feeling his rapping heart slow with them. He remained nose to nose with his fears until the storm within steadied. When he opened his eyes again, the fog of panic was gone. He looked up towards the groove of the storm god's eyelid again.
"I can do this," he insisted.
He glanced to his right side, seeing the faintest wrinkle in the rock at waist height there. Keeping his breath slow and steady, he drew his right leg up towards the wrinkle, the left foot and toes quivering with the strain of his entire body weight. His right instep scraped over the wrinkle twice before finding the merest purchase. He looked up to the storm god's eyelid once more, a thousand voices screaming in his head, telling him he was wrong. But Sarpa cried above the naysaying clamour, "Be brave! Open up the climb! Rise!" With a cry, he put all his strength into his right leg, pushing against the wrinkle, thrusting upwards. He reached above until his fingertips curled over the rounded lip of the eyelid, and a gasp of sweet relief escaped his lips. He swung his left leg up to wedge his foot into a thin vertical crack on the god's cheek, then grabbed the edge of the upper eyelid with his left hand. Now fear and euphoria battled in his breast. "Up, up, up," he mouthed euphorically, as he continued to ascend, using the many thorns in the storm god's high hat like a ladder, until the uppermost one crumbled away in his fingers. "No!" Dust puffed into his eyes, his fingertip hold fading to nothing. His hands clawed in vain for purchase and found none, his body peeling away from the rock face into the void. "No, no, no, no!" In the throes of terror, he heard a piercing shriek, saw a streak of white and hazel plumage, a sharp beak and a pair of lethal talons. The falcon swept past, releasing the end of a vine from its claws. Hattu grabbed the vine with both hands, his body jolting as his fall was halted. He hung there for a moment, mouthing a prayer to the gods through shaking lips. Then, by walking his feet against the rock face, he used the vine to climb the last stretch in a hurry. And when he reached the grassy top of the ridge, he tossed both arms gratefully onto the flat and levered himself up. He heard himself laughing as his mind and body settled. The peril of the climb was now a treasure. He sat cross-legged, tucking his hair behind his ears, then tying a strap of leather around his brow to hold it there. His gaze swept across the land. Across the forest and the chiseled heartlands of the Hittite Empire, veined with sacred rivers and ancient tracks, on to the hazy blue point of infinity where sky met land. The mystery of the horizon thrilled him and saddened him at once. He had never been allowed to journey far, never beyond these woods, and certainly never to the horizon. He recalled the previous summer, watching father leading the Hittite army from Hattusa off to the west to fight and win the Arzawan War. The king had taken his two eldest sons with him, Muwatali the Tukanti, chosen prince of the Hittite Empire, and Sarpa, next in line to the throne. Hattu had been left behind in old Ruba's scribal classroom to write out, ironically, the Epic of Gilgamesh and his far-flung adventures. And in autumn, he had watched again as the army had returned, victorious. Mua and Sarpa had ridden with the king in a chariot parade through the city, father and scions as one. The memory stung him now even more fiercely than it had done then.
"Cursed son," a wicked voice hissed in his head.
He blinked hard to stave off the voice, then drew open the small leather bag roped to his belt, lifting, weighing and checking the pale, brown-speckled falcon's egg he had collected halfway up. Intact, he realized, mustering a degree of cheer again. The air was again pierced by another shriek, coming right for him once more. He held up a stiff level arm. The falcon, who had brought him the vine, swooped down and settled on the dark brown leather bracer on his forearm, keening again and again.
"Enough, arrow, enough," Hattu chuckled.
He looked from her black eyes to the egg in his other hand.
"This. It's for Atia. It was from an abandoned nest," he reasoned. "Just like the one I found you in. But abandoned for much longer.
No chick will spring from this egg.
Another impertinent shriek.
Ah, you don't care about the egg, do you?
He realized, rustling in his bag again to produce a fat worm. No sooner had he held the specimen up than it was gone, the shrieking blessedly silenced as the falcon gulped down the meal. But the void of stillness and silence was all too brief.
Cursed son,
the voice snarled this time. It was the voice of many, of palace staff, of soldiers, of citizens in the lower town.
A cursed son,
they whispered as he passed, thinking he could not hear them.
He who cast Queen Gosula into the dark earth.
And the gossipers dispensed with whispering when one of his three brothers died of plague in his sixth summer.
Death follows that boy,
they said openly, an edge of fear in their voices. Unconsciously, and as he had become accustomed to doing when in company, he pulled a few locks of hair round from behind his ear to let them drape over his odd smoke-grey eye. It did not change who he was, but it usually meant fewer people recognized him. He stroked Arrow's head until the dark thoughts eased. When they did, he noticed something. Several danna away to the south, a cloud of terracotta dust had risen, the plume working its way towards Hattusa. Arrow's head rose too, suddenly alert.
More strange princes for the gathering. Best we return to the city also,
he sighed, standing, then lifting and flicking his wrist lightly. Arrow took off at once, heading in a straight line towards the capital with a parting shriek. Hattu set off down the less severe northern side of the ridge, and was soon making his way through the shady alder woods, the dry bracken crunching under his bare feet. He came to the chalky banks of the River Ambar, a vivid turquoise ribbon that ran through Hattusa and all the way out here. More a series of falls, pools, and gentle rapids than a true river, its waters were sacred. He waded across, the thigh-deep water as chilly as the day was hot, and up onto the far banks. There he froze, his breath held captive. A whisper of movement nearby. His head turned like an owl's, but all was still and silent. Yet when he faced forwards again, something snagged the edge of his vision once more. Something had moved. A glint of bronze, he was sure. Only warriors wore bronze. Warriors and bandits. Or worse, Kaskans. Those rugged brigands from the soaring mountains who took delight in defiling and toppling Hittite temples, who took Hittite heads as trophies. Another crunch of bracken. Closer. His heart thundered faster even than that weightless moment when he had fallen from the ridge.
Who's there?
He called out, feeling afraid and foolish at the same time. Silence. He took a step towards the forest path, timid as a fawn.
Whoosh! Twang!
Suddenly, Hattu was still. He stared at the reed arrow shaft, quivering in the dirt before him, his limbs almost buckled under him until he saw the fletchings, silver and white striped feathers from a grey-leg goose. Instantly, his fear evaporated, and a broad smile split his face.
Mua!
He cried, looking this way and that. With a crunch of bracken, Prince Muatali, Hattu's eldest brother, emerged from the shade of a nearby oak. At 16 summers, Mua towered a good 2 heads over Hattu, his thick, wavy, coal-dark locks gathering upon his muscular shoulders. His jaw was square, like a man's, and his broad, flat-boned features were handsome and hale. If Hattu resembled a fox, then Mua was a lion. He wore a black cloak, a dark kilt, and a shining white silver-scaled vest, the ancient armor of the chosen prince. Mua slung his cherrywood bow across his back and stalked towards Hattu, but his usually ice-bright eyes were shaded by a frown.
Walking the woods alone,
Mua said, his gaze on the telltale scrapes and cuts on Hattu's hands and feet.
Climbing? After Sarpa's fall?
Hattu's neck and shoulders prickled at the invisible cloak of shame that settled there.
I...
he started. Mua held up a finger, silencing him, his eyes shooting suspiciously to the nearby trees.
You hear something too?
Hattu whispered. Only now he noticed the pair of Hittite soldiers lurking further back behind Muwa. They were dressed in belted white knee-length tunics and pointed dark brown leather helms with cheek guards, aventails and bronze brow bands. Their long dark hair hung loose to their waists, animal teeth knotted in their locks. They held their spears two-handed, eyes alert, as if expecting danger.
"Word came in this morning of a small Kaskan band roving in these parts," Muwa replied, relaxing just a fraction as his suspicions faded.
Hattu shivered despite the hot sun.
"Father will be angry with me."
"Father doesn't know."
"Ruba went looking for you when you didn't turn up at the scribal school this morning. He saw you sneaking down to the city gates, but decided it would be best for your sake only to tell me."
"Ruba is old and forgetful these days, Hattu. He was lost with worry that you would come to harm."
Hattu's shoulders slumped. Muwa crouched by the arrow and worked it free from the dirt. He held up the bronze arrowhead and blew the dust from it, checked the shaft for straightness, then tucked it away in his belt quiver.
"More importantly, you are my brother, Hattu,"
he said, rising again.
"Were something to happen to Sarpa and me, then you would be father's last heir. You must not roam alone like this."
"Cursed son," the voice screamed.
Hattu's head flopped forward. He could do nothing right, it seemed. Muwa's mood loosened a little, and he wrapped an arm around Hattu's shoulders, giving him a reassuring squeeze.
"Come, brother. Let us return to the city before anyone notices. The gathering is set to begin before the afternoon is out."
Pitago crouched behind the smooth river rocks. His fingers itched to seize his axe and to rush the two young Hittites.
"Princes, no less. King Masili's heir, and the odd-eyed runt too."
He screamed inwardly, imagining the pair's heads on poles, back at his mountain villages. But the two Hittite soldiers escorting them were keen-eyed, regarding every inch of the woods around them. He had lied when he told Bagrat that he did not fear Hittite soldiers. But that was not what mattered. What mattered was that the scout believed him, that the multitudes of the north believed him. They would come together soon enough, fight for him, and deliver to him the heads of the Hittite king and all his heirs. He saw in his mind's eye once more the city of Hattusa ablaze, the streets stained with blood.
"Before winter comes," he vowed once more.
Then, with a whisper and a waved hand, he and Bagrat darted away, through the trees to the north, back towards the soaring mountains. After trekking half a dana upstream, Hattu, Muwa, and the escort soldiers emerged from the alder woods. Their eyes snapped at once to the imperious city ahead. Hattusa. Built around a craggy silver hillside, cleaved by the Ambar River Valley, narrow as an axe wound, the capital was ringed by a curtain wall the colour of pale sand, studded every 50 paces or so with square fort-like towers. Tiny forms of sentries milled along the tower tops and the battlements, their pointed bronze spear tips and helms like flames, flitting in and out of view behind the smooth triangular merlons. Wrapped within the walls was the rising jungle of the lower town, a maze of mud-brick temples, homes, workshops, taverns, and turquoise pools set on natural and quarried terraces. Crowds swarmed like ants through the streets, upon the flat rooftops and across the vine-like bridges straddling the Ambar. The silvery peaks either side of the Ambar shimmered like treasure in the sun. The southernmost and tallest tor served as the city acropolis, crowned with the great citadel, a fortress within a fortress. A thick pole jutted from the roof of the highest building, a twin-storied throne room known as the Hall of the Sun, bearing a bronze-winged sun disk gleaming in the spring sky. They followed a wheel-rutted track through the farmlands that lay before the city, golden fields of wheat, spelt, sesame, and barley, dotted with sweating, kilted men and women in simple sleeveless robes and headscarves, busy binding early harvest stalks into sheaves. Oxen harrowed fallow fields while sheep and goats grazed in green meadows. They passed beekeepers lifting drawers of sun-gold honeycomb from hives, and young milkmaids pouring clay vases of chalk-white goat milk into storage urns. As they approached Hattusa's walls, the dirt track became a well-worn paved path, alive with the clatter of ox-drawn carts and jabbering voices. The arched Tawinian gates soon loomed over them, tall as four men, with the towers flanking it another two men high again. The gates were open, but the queue to enter the city was long, a hectic contraflow of people, animals and wagons, shuffling in and out under the hard eyes of sentries on the ground and atop the gatehouse. Hattu saw the sentries stiffen suddenly, theirs and the eyes of the many falling upon Muwa.
"Tukanti!"
they hailed him. The sentries pumped clenched left fists in the air in salute as the crowds parted, like curtains, to let their chosen prince enter his city. Muwa rewarded them with a slight nod of approval. Hattu kept his head down as they passed under the gatehouse, sensing the many eyes upon them. They gazed at his older brother in awe, but he felt something else in the stares that strayed onto him, something cold and resentful. Indeed, one plague-scarred, greasy-haired, gaunt boy eyed him with disgust. He tugged a lock of hair round under his headband to cover the smoke-grey eye. He heard one of them mutter,
"See where the cursed sun walks? Always in Muatali's shadow."
Muwa's shadow. He felt the term sizzle like a brand on the back of his neck.
"It is like magic, brother, the way they part before you,"
he said to Muwa as they entered the lower town.
"They respect you. They love you."
Muwa snorted, patting his silver cuirass.
"It is my title they respect,"
he said, flashing Hattu a quick smile.
"And those in the crowd, ignore their bitter words. Cast aside our stations for a moment."
He tapped his own breastbone, then Hattu's as they walked.
"In here, we are brothers. Equals."
Hattu smiled and gazed ahead, as if the compliment had been unnecessary. In truth, it had been like a salve. They walked up the paved main way, lined with bright markets and taverns and thronged with yelling merchants, sweating workers carrying baskets on their heads and lumbering wagons bearing precious ingots of tin and copper. The air was rich with the scent of charcoal, baking bread and malting barley, and the less pleasant reek of dung and sweat. The way led over the Spirit Bridge, the ambars packed banks below, thick with women washing garments and men gathering clay. On the far side of the bridge, the road snaked steeply up the base of the Acropolis Mount. They wove past the Tablet House and the Scribal School, on across the Noon Spur, a quarried terrace that only ever saw sunlight from midday onwards. Soon, they reached the final approach to the Acropolis, a broad flagged earthen ramp. The gates at the top were sheathed in bronze, and the colossal stone lions either side gazed down upon them with black-painted eyes.
"Home,"
Hattu mused despondently as they climbed the steep ramp. When they neared the citadel, they were greeted by two elite soldiers. A Mercedi, one of the 100 chosen warriors who served as the king's bodyguard, stood resplendent in a bronze-scale corslet, leather kilt, and a high bronze helm. Beside him up there was a white-robed golden spearman from the 50-strong Acropolis Guard unit bearing the gilt spears that gave them their names. These two warriors saluted, then hauled at ropes, and the ramp gates groaned open to let them in. As soon as Hattu stepped through the shadow of the gatehouse and onto the carmine red flagstones of the Acropolis, his senses were assailed. The air was thick with the aroma of wine and roasting meats, and the clamour of shrieking laughter and high-born argo. Strangers lurked in the shadowy colonnades, clustered near the palace and by the polished stone edge of the sacred pool. Some were pale-skinned, some dark as night. Some were daubed garishly in strange dyes, others clad in lurid gowns and most dripping with jewels. There were bragging rich men and their wives, slaves, sycophants, holy men, champions and warriors. From the royal harem, fiercely painted women leaned from the shuttered windows, eyeing the fattest and richest foreigners like cats planning to corner mice. And amongst the outlanders stood members of the Panku, the tall, proud Hittite nobility, who gathered often before the king to lobby and squabble over affairs of the realm. Hattu found his gaze being dragged from one spectacle to the next, until it settled on a trio of men standing high and clear of the masses, up on the steps by the tall doorway to the Hall of the Sun. Each was a cousin of the king, and each looked over the gathered masses with deliberately cruel eyes. At once, Hattu felt his mouth grow dry, as he always did in the presence of these men. There was Zida, Gal Masedi, chief of the king's 100 bodyguards, lean, tall, and sinewy, wearing a flowing red cloak held in place by a fierce silver hawk brooch. His lips moved almost imperceptibly, whispering suspicious words to the one nearest to him. General Nuanza, the square-jawed master archer, had the powerful chest and upper arms of a bowman. Dressed in just a kilt and boots, he nodded slowly, his gaze following Zida's direction. Nuanza's night-black, sharply receding hair was gathered in three tails that sprouted from his crown. His brow was creased in concern, his black wiry eyebrows drawn together in a V. There was someone in the crowd these two disapproved of. Hattu felt a crumb of sympathy for whoever that was. But the third figure standing by the hall's entrance sent the sharpest of chills through Hattu. General Kurunta dragged his lone, mean eye, the remains of the other masked behind a tattered leathery patch, over the crowd like a scythe. His bald, umber-skinned head was dipped a fraction. The braid of silver hair sprouting from above his right ear hung down the side of his face to rest across his chest like a scorpion's tail. He was clad in a leather kilt, boots, and crossbands that hugged his bare, teak-hard chest. The hilts of the two swords sheathed on his back, jutting up behind him as if he was about to sprout wings. There was something in the way he stood, feet apart in a stance of power, shoulders tensed as if ready to reach up and snatch out his twin blades. The man reeked of menace. The people of Hattusa spoke of Kurunta One-Eye in whispers. "The breaker of men, the master of infantry," some said. "The vengeful general," others dared to say. For what man would not seek revenge, whose king had ordered the taking of his eye? Kurunta's gaze swung across the masses and halted, pinioning Hattu. Hattu felt an icy lance of panic in his breast, not sure what to do, where to look. "Ah, refreshments," Muwa said, taking two clay pots of foaming barley beer from a passing slave girl and handing one to Hattu.
"Here, I find it a good way to avoid speaking to boars," he said,
then quickly sucked on the reed straw when one dignitary swung round to engage, eyes bright and mouth primed to offer some gushing monologue. Hattu chuckled and took a sip of his own beer, bitter and refreshing, as he scanned the sea of strange faces.
"Brothers!" a voice cut through the crowd.
"Sarpa!" Muwa and Hattu replied in unison, as the king's second son barged towards them, his honey-gold eyes sparkling and his head freshly shaved, as was the way of the temple folk. At 15 summers he was as tall as Muwa, but nowhere near as muscular, his face gaunt and angular. He pushed between two dignitaries with the aid of a crutch. At the sight of the stick, Hattu felt that familiar spike of guilt. Sarpa had been following in Muwa's wake, training as a soldier, accompanying father to war. Until last autumn, when he had taken Hattu on a climb. It was a short climb, only 8 times a man's height, but it was damp that day. Hattu had slipped, and Sarpa had caught him, only to fall himself, shattering a hip on the rocks. The limb had healed, but now Sarpa's gait was shambling at best, and his military days were over. Now he spent his time serving as a priest at the Storm Temple in the lower town. The three brothers embraced. Hattu winced inwardly.
"I'm sorry, brother."
When they drew apart, he smiled to mask his true feelings.
"How was it?" Sarpa whispered to him. "The climb," he clarified with a grin, seeing Hattu's confusion. "I see the rock dust under your fingernails."
Hattu smiled genuinely this time.
"It was incredible. My heart was fit to burst with pride when I reached the top."
He thought of the falcon egg in his satchel and added, "Is Atia here yet?"
"The priestesses will be here soon," Sarpa smiled.
Then from the high end of the citadel grounds, the thick, metallic clash of a gong sounded. All heads turned to the Hall of the Sun. With a rumble of feet, the crowds poured towards the towering throne room's entrance. The gathering was about to commence. Hattu beheld the tall doorway. Of all the hard faces and doubting eyes out here, it was the judgment of the man inside he feared most of all. Chapter 2. The Gathering. Spring 1303 BC. Crowds took their places on the benches lining three sides of the hall, a dozen Mercedi and golden spearmen standing watch before them. The chatter faded towards a whisper, and all eyes turned to the semicircular stone-carved dais at the hall's western end, as if guided there by the broad fingers of reddening, late-afternoon sunlight that shone in from the high-arched windows. Atop the dais were two limestone lions, passant, each with one paw raised as if ready to stride forth, and they bore the seat of Hittite power upon their backs. The sacred grey throne was deliberately plain, fashioned from cedar and cold-hammered rivets of iron, a stubborn, hoary metal that fell from the skies. King Masili sat upon the royal seat draped in a blue linen robe, the silver-winged sun-circlet on his brow, the only kingly trapping on his person. As a final reverberating clash of the bronze gong chased the remaining whispers from the hall, he glanced at the polished bronze scepter resting on the right arm of the throne. His reflection stared back at him, his eyes glazed and pouchy, his expression melancholic and his face wide and jowly. Even his once sleek, dark locks were now riddled with spidery white strands. Life as Labana had been hard, devouring his youth like a leech. An endless succession of rites and rituals in honour of the gods had him trekking eternally across the Hittite heartlands to its holy cities. And when the gods were appeased, war quickly filled the gaps. And through it all, one name had echoed eternally in his heart. "Sweet Gasula," he wept inwardly. At first he had blamed the midwives. Then he had exiled the augurs, and he had even raged at his late stepmother, who had chosen the birthing staff. His anger had been like a ravening, insatiable predator for a time. He realized his eyes had settled on one face in the crowd, the one he had chosen over his wife. Hattu, upon whom his grief had fastened, festered, and grown into something misshapen and cruel. The boy's odd eyes were wide and fearful. He was barefoot and dressed in only a scuffed, threadbare kilt, his hair tousled, in stark contrast to his flanking brothers, the tall, princely Mua, and the lame but still majestic Sarpa. Ishtar, ever present in his thoughts since that dark night, spoke from somewhere deep within.
"It will begin on the day he stands by the banks of the Amber, soaked in the blood of his brother."
He barely noticed that silence had long taken over from the faded gong until something snagged his attentions. Someone shuffling uncomfortably down on the bench to the right of the throne, like a cat pawing at its feeding bowl, trying to attract the attention of its owner. It was his great scribe, Ruba, his owl eyes fixed on the scepter, his winged eyebrows rising in concern.
My son," Ruba said, his voice tremulous.
Zeta, sitting on the bench beside Ruba, rolled his inky eyes, chuckling darkly with Korunta and Nuanza. Ruba shot the military trio a sour look, then turned back to the king.
"We should get things underway as soon as we can."
"You wish to hold court in my place, old goose?" Masili whispered back.
He loved Ruba, but the old fellow was like a nagging concubine at times. Ruba dropped back to the bench and shook his head. Lifting the scepter in his own time, Masili drew a long breath and swept his gaze around the room, meeting every eye.
"My loyal kings, your presence gladdens me," he lied. Areniti, the sun goddess, and Halki, god of the grain, have been kind, for our fields are thick with crop this year. Together, we trade our wares and make for a stronger world.
He settled the scepter across his knees, indicating that the tributes were to commence.
First came the king of Ugarit, a thriving market town, the trade hub of the world, some would say, perched on the coast of northern Retenu, not far from the Egyptian borders. This alliance was a vital one, ensuring the Hittite merchants who travelled there received good rates on the vital tin ingots, wine, oil, flax, timber, and much more. The king's skin was dark as old leather, telling of his life under the unforgiving eastern sun, and contrasting sharply with his white cap and cape. The crowd rose respectfully as he crossed the black flagstone floor and climbed the stairs towards the throne, the echoes of his footsteps rising to the high ceiling like the flapping wings of scattered doves. Bowing at the neck, he offered Mersili an ostrich egg, silvered and dotted with jasper and beryl.
My son, I bring you this treasure, and outside waits a wagon with 500 golden shekels and 2 fine silver cups.
His words of tribute and a description of the gift were recorded by junior scribes, Ruber's underlings, their hands a blur as they tapped their reed styluses at woodpecker-like speed into their soft clay tablets. Most generous, brother king, Mersili replied. May the gods continue to bless Ugarit's fleet with good trade winds.
The king of Ugarit bowed again as he left the plinth. Next came the Lucans from the fertile southwestern lowlands. Their yellow-cloaked chosen chieftain shuffled up the semicircle of steps, his soft leather slippers squeaking and his feather headdress swaying and shuddering like the tail of an ungainly peacock. He held out a hunting bow, a fine piece made from ash and ibex horn, the handle dotted with pearl and the ears fashioned as serpents' heads.
May this bow fell game for you with your every shot, or, he added with a toadying look, strike down the encroaching armies of your enemies.
The oily words were intended to please, but Mersili felt angry, like one who had a stain on his gown pointed out to him before a group of friends. He fixed a false look of equanimity on his face and replied, No bow could strike my enemies and their forces. They cringe far beyond my borders.
It was a lie, but a necessary one. A series of vassal kings approached, and the gifts stacked up. Next came the purple-cloaked Trojan king. Mersili's decorum wavered, and it was all he could do to stop his face breaking into a rare smile.
My son,
King Alexandru said with regal poise. Then his resolve failed, and he added with a whisper,
Comrade.
A smile marched across his face, as bright as the gold and silver banded scale vest he wore. The king of Troy and ruler of the western vassal state of Velusa was Mersili's age, but far fresher faced. He carried his helm, crested with a stiff, curled tail of leather like a coiled whip, under arm, wore his nut-brown locks combed back from his brow without a parting, and his short beard was expertly groomed to fill out his handsome face. His green eyes shone like gems.
It has been too long.
Aye, Mersili replied. Though longer for me than for you. I seem to have aged 40 years since last we met, and you're still but a young man.
Alexandru started to laugh, but stifled it when he sensed the many jealous eyes around the hall scrutinizing the interaction.
He brings no gift,
one gull-voiced member of the crowd called out. Alexandru's face hardened for just a moment.
I, Alexandru of Troy, Lermadon of Velusa, would not dare enter my son's halls without bearing gift.
He addressed the crowd, then turned back to the king.
On Hattusa's southern approaches wait 80 sorrel-red stallions, broken and trained upon the plains of the Scamander. 40 chariots they will pull for you. 40 reasons for any who dare even look upon your borders to think again.
Mersili allowed a smile to play on his lips as he dipped his head fractionally to show his gratitude, first to Alexandru, then to the Trojan king's wife, Placia, who stood back down in the crowd with a contingent of Trojan guardsmen. The last time he had seen her, she had been heavy with child. Now she carried a babe in her arms. Alexander spotted Massili's interest.
Just as I bear two names, we have given him two also, Podesis and Priam. The augurs give us mixed messages, he whispered. They trouble me with their words, but I have faith in the gods. My boy will grow to be strong and wise, and he will preside over a glorious time for Troy and her allies.
As Alexander spoke, Massili noticed Hattu just beyond the Trojan king's shoulder, shuffling where he stood.
The west will dim with black boats' hulls, Trojan heroes, mere carrion for gulls,
Ishtar whispered. Massili smiled to mask his disquiet.
Good fortune to you and your beloved friend, he said.
Always.
Always.
Alexander genuflected and turned to leave. The next to ascend the throne dais was an odd one, his skin the shade of river clay. He was slender, shaven-headed, and sported a jutting, squared beard that hung to the copper pectoral necklace on his bare chest. He wore a pale linen kilt and a shawl covering his back and shoulders. The fellow's dark eyes held a hint of something parlous and untamed. There, and not there, at once, like the glimpse of a serpent swimming in a deep black tarn. Egyptian, Massili realized, shooting a look to Ruba, whose face was creased in confusion as he scanned his clay tablet of attendees. Egypt was no part of the Hittite world. Indeed, the colossal empire at the southern edge of the world was just the opposite. Probably the biggest rival of the Hittite realm, alongside the avaricious Assyrian Empire.
Great King Massili, Labana, the fellow said. I am Sataya of Memphis, messenger of your brother king, Pharaoh Horamhep, lord of the two lands, son of Ra, Horus of gold.
Massili beheld him with a carefully blank expression. Rumor was strong that Pharaoh Horamhep spent his days revolutionizing the mighty desert armies in preparation for war. More, in recent summers, there had been raids on the southeastern vassal land of Amuru, one of the Hittite throne's most tenuous possessions. Brigands, most said. Desert raiders and no more, others claimed. But why, then, had some of the captured raiders been in possession of Egyptian gold? Massili's chest tightened. With every passing season, the prospect of a Hittite-Egyptian war grew like a gathering black pall.
My master offers you this,
Sataya held out an elephant's tusk, finely polished. Massili studied the piece, admiring its beauty but uncertain what the odd markings on it were supposed to be. He thought of the rare elephant herds roaming in the Hittite heartlands, and felt a pang of sadness that such a creature had died to provide this oversized trinket. But, he thought as he turned an appraising eye on the Egyptian dignitary, did this gift offer hope? Might war be avoided?
While I did not expect Pharaoh to be represented at this gathering, I appreciate his fine gift, and in exchange...
He halted, now understanding the markings. They were a depiction of lands and rivers and great seas, not just the Hittite realm, but all to the west, east, and south as well. Egypt was marked out at the bottom of the etching, yet it had no borders. Where currently the Egyptian realm touched the Assyrian Empire and Hittite lands in the patchwork of vassal kingdoms known as retinue, this chart showed no such boundaries, with all Assyrian and Hittite holdings contained inside the Egyptian domain, like conquered subjects.
It is a map,
Sataya advised Massili through a well-practiced smile. Massili's heart hardened, the glimmer of hope vanishing. He stared into the envoy's eyes for a time before speaking again.
And what does my brother king ask of me in return?
Sataya's eyes narrowed.
Pharaoh requests a small gift of iron. Iron of heaven.
Massili might have laughed had the tension not been so high. His blacksmiths had strived fastidiously to craft the few divine meteorites that fell upon Hittite lands into daggers and axes. 7 such weapons were locked in the royal armory. Hard blades, harder than bronze. But they were brittle and useless as true weapons. Still, they were rare treasures, and he would be damned if he was going to gift one to his enemy.
"Do this, and he will send you,"
Satea continued, his veil of civility slipping,
"a vast shipment of tin. With it, you could make many jackets of bronze armor. A prudent investment."
His eyes traced the taunting markings on the tusk map.
"In these dangerous times."
Massili's jaw worked at the twin meaning, anger broiling within him as Satea's lips twitched in triumph. He leant forward briskly on the throne, primed to rise. He could set Zeda, his 2 generals, or any of the finely armed guards loose upon this dog. He could hang the beggar from the city walls and let the crows peck at his eyes. But the thunder in his heart steadied. The gods guided him, and he knew what he had to do.
"Your master needn't have bothered sending me tusk etchings," the king said in a low, steady burr. "I have scholars of my own who can draw our borders with far greater accuracy. And extra weapons? I have no need for them. Have you seen my divisions in their pomp? They shine and clatter heavy with sharpened bronze of their own."
He inhaled slowly through his nostrils and sat tall upon the throne. When he spoke next, each word was like the slow, deliberate strike of a smith's hammer.
"Pharaoh will have no iron.